All right, tonight we're in 2 Samuel chapters 19 and 20. You remember from last week, very important for tonight, you remember David has left Jerusalem because he heard of the insurrection or rebellion by his son Absalom as he was rounding up people, had been for a few years prior to. And he heard word that they were on their way to Jerusalem to take over because Absalom wanted to be king. So David left with the people of the city, the women and children, the men in his army. And after David had left, he did a couple of things. First of all, Ahithophel, his chief counsel, stayed with Absalom, stayed behind in order to give counsel to Absalom. But Cushai, one of David's other counselors, was sent by David to go back and to counter the counsel of Ahithophel. David also sent back the Ark of the Covenant of God, along with Abiathar and Zadok, the high priest, sent them back to Jerusalem to be under Absalom, and yet to send him word. And what we were told, that a young gal would come out with the word from the priests and tell their sons, and the sons would come across and out into the wilderness and bring David word as to what is going on. So last week when we took chapter 17 and 18, we saw that chapter 17, verses 1 to 4, that Ahithophel gave counsel to Absalom that he go quickly and overcome David because he said he's weary, he's broken down, he's got women and children with him. Now's the time to go after him and to destroy him. But in verses 5 to 13 or 14, Cushai was asked what his counsel was. And Cushai said just the opposite. He said, you know, David, your father, he's an experienced warrior. You know that he's not going to be put himself in a position to be taken captive. You also know that you ought to be the one leading the army against him when you do go up against him. So you need a lot of people. So gather the entire nation together and then go down after him and you lead them. So he appealed to two things. He appealed to fear and he appealed to Absalom's ego. And Absalom liked that. He liked the glory. But see, Cushai gave that counsel to give David more time and to get him word. Now, Ahithophel knew that. Ahithophel knew that if his counsel was not taken, that there was no chance of overcoming David. And so that's why in verse 23 of chapter 17, Ahithophel got his house in order and committed suicide, because he knew that they were going to fail in the rebellion and that David would come after him. And so he killed himself. And so the priests in verses 15 to 22 of chapter 17, the high priest Zadok and Abiathar, Cushai went to them and said, send word to David as to what's happening. We've got him some time now. And so they sent word out to them. And verses 24 through 29 of chapter 17, David went across the river Jordan to a city called Mahanaim. It was a walled city on the other side of the river. And there he received provisions from the various kings and leaders from that side of the Jordan. They were his friends. And so that's where David went to set up his fortress, so to speak, inside this walled city, and he received provision from the people in the area. Then in chapter 18, David sent out, in verses 1 to 5, he sent out his armies to go up against Absalom. He heard Absalom was coming. He sent out his armies in three different companies, but he gave commandment to be gentle with his son Absalom. Now, verses 6 through 8 of chapter 18 is the battle. One verse only is verse 7 of chapter 18, where it talks about the battle. The battle did not last very long. It was in rugged terrain in the forest, and Absalom's army was wiped out. And then in verses 9 to 15 of chapter 18, we saw the death of Absalom himself. Remember, he was stuck in the oak tree as he was riding by. His head was stuck in the oak tree and he was hanging there. And you remember what Absalom said. He said, be gentle with Absalom, don't do anything to him. And so he came and reported to Joab. A man found him, came and reported to Joab what he found, and Joab was surprised. Why didn't you kill him? So Joab went with 10 men, and they killed him. They killed Absalom. And so, in verses 16 to 18 of chapter 18, Absalom blew the trumpet, and all of Israel retreated back. This is to Mahanaim, on the other side of the Jordan. They retreated back because the battle was over. And then in verses 19 through 23, two runners went to go back, because David was sitting at the gate of the city of Mahanaim, and two runners were sent. Actually, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, wanted to go, and Joab says, no, you better not go. You don't have quite the information necessary. So he sent a Cushite to go. But Ahimaaz eventually talked Joab into it. He overran the Cushite and got to David first. And he told David that the war was over. And he says, what about my son? Is he safe? And he said, well, I really don't have that information. So David says, well, then stand aside. And he waited for the second runner, the Cushite, to come. And we're in verses 24 through 32. And the Cushite comes and in a very delicate way tells David that his son Absalom is dead. Verse 33 of chapter 18, which is where we left off last week. The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said this, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. In other words, if I had died instead of you. O Absalom, my son, my son. So he is now weeping and he is now lamenting over his son. Now remember, he's still in Mahanaim. He has not come back to Jerusalem yet. And when we begin chapter 19, I want you to picture in your mind what we're dealing with. We're on the other side of the Jordan in Mahanaim, okay? But over where Israel is, there are actually two parts to Israel. And there's the Judah side, there's the two tribes, and there's Judah. That is called the area of Judah. And within the capital of Judah is Jerusalem. And then there's the northern 10 tribes, and they are called Israel. Now, as we see it in our text tonight, these two factions, they're all Jews. But it's kind of like in the Civil War here in the United States, the North and the South. You have North Israel, you have South Israel. And we are going to see that they're going to be contending with each other, politically and militarily, after the death of Solomon, after we get into 1 Kings, and after Solomon takes over for David. At the death of Solomon, civil war actually breaks out in Israel, the north against the south. And so we're dealing with David and his people across the river. Now on the other side, we have both Israel, the northern 10 tribes, and we have Judah. And now that Absalom has been killed and his army has been defeated, all is not well. David's going to have quite a time reuniting Israel. Not just because of Absalom and the insurrection against him. That didn't last very long. But the undermining of Absalom over the years, of course, played a role in this. But David is finding out that over the years, in his luxury and in his ease and in his laxity about sin, is that the entire nation has fallen apart. And he is really going to have a problem now. He is going to be restored to the throne. He will, in a masterful way, as God has given him the ability, he is going to put Israel back together again. But just as Nathan the prophet said in chapter 12, the sword is not going to leave his household. It's going to be constant problems for him. Constant fighting within the family. Constant fighting to get to the throne. And it was because of his sin. But we have a problem with David. The problem is with his son Absalom. Yes, David was aware that everything that was happening was because of his sin, just like Nathan the prophet prophesied it would happen. That's why David never complained about all of this, and he submitted to it. It just happened. I mean, David just kind of rolled with the punches. Because he didn't complain to God, because God had already told him, this is the way it's going to be because of your sin. But there was a problem that he had with his son. And we'll see it in our text now. Look at verse 90. Chapter 19, verses 1 through 8, we have the grief of David. Remember, David is in the chamber over the gate, and he's weeping, and he is mourning over the death of his son. Chapter 19, verse 1. And it was told to Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning over Absalom." So the victory or deliverance that day became mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, the king is grieved over his son. Now, as we'll see as we read on, there's a problem. The people said, we have victory. Absalom's dead. His army has been defeated. Now we can go home. We can celebrate the victory here, first of all. And we can go home and we can become a nation again. And all of a sudden they hear, well, David is up in the upper chamber mourning over his son. And the people said, where's the victory? They're not trying to be cruel to him. But we'll see in a moment that Joab comes in and rebukes David for what he's doing. He's going to tell them, look, there's a nation out there waiting for you. There's people out there that depend on you to come out and to lead them. And he's also going to tell them, you have been neglecting these people all these years. And you've got to come now. You've got to get it together. And you've got to go out there and lead these people. Notice what verse 3 says. And the people stole back into the city that day, as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. Now they're coming back to Mahanaim, and they're doing it very quietly. They're not celebrating. They're sneaking back into the city like people who are ashamed, you see. Like people who are sneaking, like they're still in the battle, and they don't want the enemy to hear them. And it's because of their own king, who is in mourning over his son. But the king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." And so now the rebuke of Joab. Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, "Today you have disgraced all your servants." More literally, "Today you have shamed the face of your servants, who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemy." I'm going to read this to you literally. Verse 6, this is the key to the entire lesson tonight. This is the key to David's life. "In that you love those who hate you, and you hate those who love you." That's how it literally reads. You love the ones who hate you, and you hate the ones that love you. He loved Absalom, who hated him. He said, give him a break. And yet his own people who were loyal to him and his own family that were dependent on him, basically he just gave them up, seemingly. Look what he goes on to say. "For you have declared today that you regard neither officers nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well." He says, the only thing you care about is Absalom. And I get a sense today that you disregard your officers, your servants, everybody around you, and that if everybody had died and only Absalom lived, that you'd probably be very happy. "Now, therefore, arise, go out, and speak comfort to your servants." The word comfort is the word heart. It literally means go out and speak to the heart of your servants. "For I swear by Yahweh, if you do not go out, not one person will stay with you this night. And that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now." The word worse is also the word evil. And that will be evil for you, more than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. So he says the people are about ready to pack up and leave. You've disgraced them. You have shamed them. And they're not going to stay with you tonight unless you're going to lead them. You have neglected them for a long, long time. Better get your act together. Or when you wake up in the morning, nobody's going to be here but you. Then the king arose and sat in the gate. And they told all the people, saying, "There is the king, sitting in the gate." So all the people came before the king, for everyone of Israel had fled to his tent. Now verses 9 and 10. It tells of the quarrel that begins, and you have to understand that this is between Judah and Israel on the other side. Now all the people were in a dispute. Literally, they were quarreling in all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing?" Literally, why are you silent about bringing back the king? So all of a sudden, and this is on the other side of the Jordan, the people are saying, Absalom's dead. David's on the other side of the river with our people over there. Why is everybody so silent and no one is calling for the king to come back? So that's what's going on over there. Well, on the other side, now beginning at verse 11, verses 11 through 23, David is going to send over. So the king David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all of Israel have come to the king, to his very house?" So Israel is over there with Judah, and Israel is saying, how come you guys are silent, and how come you guys aren't trying to bring the king back? And so David says, yeah. So he sends messengers back over there to Judah saying, how come you are so silent? You're the last ones to say anything about bringing the king back. He says, "You are my brethren," verse 12. "You are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh?" Now remember, we introduced him to you last time, is that Absalom had placed Amasa over the armies instead of Joab when Absalom became the puppet king, as he took over when David fled. So Amasa, but Amasa was the cousin to Absalom and the nephew to David. So Amasa, Absalom's dead, so Amasa is just sitting out there doing nothing. So he said, "Say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me, and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab." Isn't that interesting? David replaces Joab with Amasa himself. Because Joab's over there with David, and Amasa's with Absalom. And they're the commanders of each of the armies. Amasa is still back in Judah, in Jerusalem. And he says, "Send word to Amasa that when I come back, he is going to take Joab's place." Joab's out as commander-in-chief. And Amasa's in. Very brilliant move, politically and militarily. What David is doing is, he is now reversing himself. He sees that he has stayed with the people that have been with him over the years. He's got his private army of 600 men. He's got Joab, who is an experienced military commander. But what he sees about the nation is that he's got his little in-crowd, and the entire nation is on the outside. Now he's starting to include other people. He's actually going to open up the army. Instead of it being a private army, it is now going to be a civilian militia led by Amasa. He's going to have both armies, the professional army and the civilian army. He's going to bring in people from the various tribes. So he's going to start making people be included so that the nation can be united. It's a very smart thing to do, because the people are wondering, okay, when David comes back, and you know, and David hears about the northern 10 tribes arguing, quarreling with Judah. And so he says, what we're going to do is appoint one of their leaders as the commander-in-chief. You know, Amasa all of a sudden is like, hey, yeah, David's all right after all. Hey. And so now David's going to, Amasa is going to be on David's side. It's a political move. But Joab isn't going to like that, as you can imagine. Verse 14, so he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah. He's making political moves now to win the hearts of the people of Judah. Just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, return, you and all your servants. Then the king returned and came to the Jordan. So he still hasn't crossed over yet. And Judah came to Gilgal to go meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. And Shimei, I don't know if you remember him or not, but back in chapter 16, he's the one that threw stones at David and cursed him. If you remember, the word curse means to belittle him. Well, he now comes. First of all, Judah greets him. We're going to see three different groups here. Shimei comes, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. So now he comes down and he bows down in obedience and submission to David as king. He once cursed him, threw stones at him. Now he's kneeling down before him. And he brings 1,000 Benjamites with him to greet David as he's coming across the Jordan, along with Judah. It says also that Ziba, now Ziba was the servant to Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was Jonathan's son, who was lame, if you remember. And Ziba was his servant, left to him by his father Saul. And so Ziba is the one that brought David some provisions, even though Mephibosheth didn't come. So anyway, he comes out, Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they went over the Jordan before the king. And then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household. The word ferry boat, obviously, I mean, that's kind of obvious that that's not what the Hebrew means. There's no Hebrew for ferry boat. Literally, they carried the king's goods from one side to the other. So they had some kind of a flotilla or something, something made to bring everything across and carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. Then he said to the king, this is Shimei's expression of repentance. Shimei says, do not let my Lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my Lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my Lord the king. But Abishai, Joab's brother, is listening. He's the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? Again, the word cursed is the word belittled, to make light of. So shouldn't he die because of this, David? And David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? He is really getting perturbed. He's already replaced Joab. He says, I've just had it up to here with the Joab thing. You know, Joab's killing everybody. He killed my son. I said, don't do that. He's just killing everybody. So, and plus I want to make a political move to win over the hearts of the people so they'll ask me to come back and that we can all be united. And now Joab's brother says, let's kill this guy too. I mean, David's sitting there going, this guy's repented. What more do you want, you know? So he says, What have I to do, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel?" He says, look, how is this guy a threat to me? He's repented. He's bowing down before me as his king. So what is the problem? In fact, his expression shows that he is more perturbed with the sons of Zeruiah than he is with Shimei. Therefore the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." And the king made an oath to him. Now in verses 24 to 30, he meets Mephibosheth. Remember, he's the lame one. He's the one that Ziba came, Mephibosheth being the son of Jonathan, who was the son of Saul. Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, meaning descendants, came down to meet the king, and he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. This is the sign of mourning and prayer. He didn't keep himself up. It's like sitting in sackcloth and ashes. You don't groom yourself. You just sit there and pray. You just don't do anything. And he didn't do anything. He was a dirty mess. His clothes were dirty. His feet were filthy, dirty, didn't wash his feet. His mustache, his hair was just completely undone because he hadn't groomed himself. And obviously he has been in intercession and prayer and mourning all this time since David left the city. So it was when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" And he answered, "My lord, O king, my servant, deceived me. For your servant said, 'I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king.'" He says, because your servant's lame. He says, you know, I'm lame. I can't get to you. And so my servant came and said, "I'll saddle the donkey for you." But he deceived me. He didn't do that. So I had no way to get to you. Secondly, "And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king." That is, he came to you and told you things that weren't true. "But my lord the king is like the angel or messenger of God. Therefore do what is good in your eyes." And so that's really what won David over. He knew that Mephibosheth was telling him the truth. And you can always tell if someone is telling the truth because basically they tell you the truth, but then they leave it up to you. "If you don't believe me, just do to me whatever you wish. You're the king. Whatever seems good in your eyes, if you want to put me to death because you think I'm a traitor," and he already has the look of somebody who he hasn't kept himself up. He's been praying and mourning and fasting because David left town. And he says his servant deceived him. And so he says, "Just therefore do what's good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant amongst those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out anything anymore to the king?" He says, "When you first came back and took over king, you had mercy on me and restored my father's household. You let me sit at your own table and eat. So how can I complain any more than that? I didn't even deserve that. How can I complain about anything? You should have put me to death when you took over as king, because I was next in line." And that's what the kings did. They just wiped out the nearest descendant so that they're not a threat to take over the throne, you see. So he says, "You had mercy on me. Just let me sit at your table. So, you know, if you kill me now, I've actually gotten more than I deserve." So the king said to him, verse 29, "Why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, 'You and Ziba divide the land.' Then Mephibosheth said to the king, 'Rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house.'" He says, let Ziba have the whole thing. Because David said, "Look, I divided it between you and Ziba. Take the land. Why are you talking to me about your matters? Just go take care of, go do it. Nobody's taking anything away from you. All I wanted to know is, why didn't you come with me? You know, what's the problem? When I left, why didn't you come?" Well, he says, "You know, I'm lame and servant tried to saddle the donkey, and he deceived me, and he slandered me to you, making you believe that I didn't want to come. He says, no, that wasn't the case. I just physically could not make it, so I sat here and prayed in sackcloth until you came back. And now that you're back, if you don't believe my story, if you think I'm a traitor, go ahead, do me in. I've actually gotten more than what I've deserved up to this time to begin with. So he says, let him have it all. You've come back to peace, to your own house, and that's all that matters. And then Barzillai, verses 31 to 39. And Barzillai, the Gileadite, came down from Rogalim and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. Now Barzillai was a very aged man. Now Barzillai was one of the rich men across the river that was supplying him, David and his men and people, with food over in Mahanaim. And David comes to Barzillai, and Barzillai is now 80 years old. And he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed in Mahanaim, for he was a very rich man. And the king said to Barzillai, come across with me, and I will provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem. But Barzillai said to the king, how long have I to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? Today I'm 80 years old. Can I discern between good and bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? In other words, just the normal functions of life. He can hardly taste the difference between food. He can't hear singing anymore. He can't participate in the festivals. He's just going to be a burden. Your servant's just going to be a burden to you if I go along with you. Your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king. And why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant turn back again, that I may die in my own city, near the grave of my father and mother. But here is your servant, Kimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king, and do for him what seems good to you. And the king answered, Kimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now whatever you request of me, I will do it for you. Then all the people went over the Jordan. And when the king had crossed over, the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. So he's basically, I have all my friends and security and home here. To get replaced at 80 years old and not be able to function there, I'll just be a burden to people. So I'll just stay behind and die here. And he sent his servant with David to be a help to him, and it was a gift to David to do that. And so this is the first time that David is crossing over the Jordan. Verses 40 to 43 gets to this dealing between Israel and Judah. Now the king went to Gilgal, and Kimham went on with him. And all the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. Just then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across the Jordan? So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative of ours. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 shares in the king. Therefore, that is to say, they have 10 tribes, so that's, you know, if there's 12 tribes in Israel, Israel has 10 out of 12 voices here. They got votes here. He might be flesh of your flesh and bone of your bones, Israel is saying, the northern 10 tribes. But we've got 10 parts out of 12 here. We've got the majority. We got 10 shares in the king. Therefore, we also have more right to David than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back our king? So there's Israel saying, we think the king ought to come back, and we came to you and said, why are you guys so silent? Now you guys are taking credit for it, you know. You guys are the ones not doing anything. Now you guys did it, and we look bad. Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. In other words, their words prevailed. Now, this brings up verses 1 and 2. We're going to have another rebellion and revolt. Now, David's just on his way back and all these things are happening. And there happened to be there a rebel. And in the Hebrew, it's literally the son of Belial, which some English translations translate it, he's worthless. It's like saying he's the son of the devil. In fact, I had somebody come to me one time. It was a female, a woman, that said that her mother told her that she was a child of the devil when she was younger because she was always doing evil, and she was called the child of the devil. Well, that's basically what they're saying. So there happened to be there a rebel. The word rebel is literally the term in Hebrew, a son of Belial, or son of the devil, or a worthless one, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite, and he blew a trumpet and said, he's taken advantage of this verbal war now. We have no share in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. So now he's going to start a revolt against David. You'd think everything is going to be fine. But see, David's learning that all these years his nation has been falling apart. He has not led them. He's been sitting in his palace, and he has not treated them or had a relationship with them like he should. So every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah, from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem, remained loyal to their king. Verse 3 tells us what David did when he got back to Jerusalem. Remember the concubines that were left behind to watch the palace, and remember Absalom went into them in public in order to disgrace his father and to claim the kingship. Well, what happens to these women? Now David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, who had been left to keep the house, and put them in seclusion and supported them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. So they were defiled. They were defiled women because Absalom had gone into them. So they were given living quarters, and they were not to come in contact with David the king again, and they lived out their lives this way. They were supported and taken care of, but they no longer functioned as concubines nor married to anyone, and they died as widows. And then, remember, Amasa was put in charge. David sent word to put Amasa instead of Joab. He was replaced. Well, in verse 4 it says, and the king said to Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days, and be present here yourself. Now remember, Israel is taking up war. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time when David had appointed him. Now in the Hebrew, in verse 5, it denotes that he did it on purpose. David gave him 3 days. He took his time. Whether he wanted David to fail, nobody knows. You know, it could be that he wanted the whole David to fail and Israel to overcome David. Now that that Amasa was second in command, maybe when David dies, Amasa takes over. You see. So Amasa delays, and David said to Abishai. Now Abishai is Joab's brother. He puts him in charge. He says, "Okay, if Amasa can't get it together in 3 days." You. He says, now that Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us. So Joab's men, with the Carathites and with the Pelethites and all the mighty men, these were the mercenaries from different nations, yes, sir?
Joab still?
He's still in the army. But he's not commander. He's not in charge.
Well, I was wondering why they call him Joab's men.
Because there were men who were under his command. He still has command. But he's not the commander of the whole army. See? He still has command of them. He is not in charge of the mercenaries. But he is in command probably of the 600 that were the private army. Because we now have a civilian army as well as mercenaries. That would be people from other nations, men from other nations who are also part of the army. You've got a three-part army going here. So, and all the mighty men went out after him, middle of verse 7, and they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now when they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them. Now Joab was dressed in battle armor. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. Then Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in health, my brother?" Now it's kind of convenient that he would lean forward in his and his sword fall out of the sheath, and he kind of leans over to pick it up as if he's going to put it back in his sheath, and he's got Amasa in front of him, and he says, "Are you okay, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his insides poured out on the ground, and he did not strike him again. Thus he died. Then Joab and Abishai his brother pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Well, Joab's really getting quite a reputation, isn't he? Remember, back in chapter 3, he killed the commander who was under Saul and killed him the same way, tricked him to come out. He's killing people right and left, killed David's son Absalom when the king said don't kill him. And now Amasa, who was appointed over him, he now kills Amasa. Not saying that it was a bad thing, but this is what's happening with Joab in that Amasa delayed rounding up the men for a purpose, presumably so that David's armies would fail and not catch up with Sheba. But so Joab and his brother, Abiathar, take off to go after Sheba, the son of Bichri. Verse 11, meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, follow Joab." But Amasa wallowed in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the men saw, when the man saw that all the people stood still, he moved Amasa from the highway to the field and threw a garment over him. And when he saw that everyone who came upon him halted. And when he was removed from the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. So all the people just stopped. Here's Amasa's body laying there in blood in the middle of the highway. And they wouldn't dare pass over this dead body in the middle of the highway. So Joab says, "Well, I'll fix that." He just dragged him over and threw him over on the side of the highway and put a garment over him so nobody would see him. So then they said, "Okay, let's go." Off they went. Verse 14. And he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Ma'achah. That would be in northern Palestine as a location. And all the Berites. So they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. Then they came and besieged him in Abel of Beth Ma'achah. And they cast up a siege mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman cried out from the city, "Hear, hear! Please say to Joab, come nearby that I may speak with you." And when he had come near to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I'm listening." So she spoke, saying, "They used to talk in former times, saying, they shall surely seek guidance at Abel," meaning that city, and so they would end disputes." And so she's saying that there's a proverb about this city, and she's quoting the proverb, which is very difficult to translate into English. But basically she's saying when people had disputes, they used to come to Abel and settle their disputes. That's the kind of city that you're coming up against. He says, I am amongst the peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. So first of all, she's saying there's a proverb that hangs over this city. The city is known for settling disputes. We don't make war, we make peace. Secondly, it is considered to be a mother in Israel. It's a center point, like a parent to the tribes of Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? So we're Jews. We practice Israeli customs. We want the peace of our people. If you want help, you can come here and find it. We are not enemies. So why are you going to swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? And Joab answered and said, far be it from me that I should swallow it up or destroy it. This is not so. But a man from the mountains of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. So the woman said to Joab, watch, his head will be thrown to you over the wall. Then the woman, in her wisdom, went to the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. Then he blew a trumpet, and they withdrew from the city, every man to his tent. And so Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. Now in verses 23 to 26, now all of this happens in David's return to Jerusalem. How he used his wisdom to unite and make political moves and political gestures, make war plans, all to unite Israel back together again. There was a revolt with Sheba, so David wanted to take care of that. There's fighting. The sword is coming up against his household constantly because of his sin. And so one thing that tips us off in this chapter about a change in David, about something that he learned, he said about Sheba in verse 6 of chapter 20, that if we don't take care of this insurrection with Sheba, it could be worse than with Absalom. He's changed. He has learned his lesson. He sees this as being worse than Absalom. Let's take care of it now. I didn't take care of the Absalom situation when I should have, because he's my son. But he was a threat to me, and he's a threat to all of Israel. Remember what was said before by Joab? You love the ones who hate you, and you hate the ones that love you. The people who are loyal to you, you gave us up because of your son. And he's the one that hates you and hates us. You've done a flip-flop here. What he's finding is that over the years, the entire nation has been falling apart. But he recognizes that he has to take care of the insurrection and the rebellion, whether it be his son or no matter who it is. He has got to take care of, there has to be proper discipline and the proper things taken care of in order to run this nation of Israel as king and to be a faithful king. And so all this happens as because there's been a breakdown over the years. He has not been taking care of the nation and leading the nation like he should have. And he's been wallowing over Absalom. You remember when Amnon was killed. Ever since Absalom killed Amnon, he's been wallowing in this thing for years. It's like, snap out of it. It's okay to mourn. But, you know, there's other people to take care of. There's other things to do. You have to keep going on. You can't just sit there feeling sorry for yourself. There's a healthy expression of mourning, and yet there's an unhealthy expression of mourning. When you live as if life's over, for me, until somebody reminds you, excuse me, but there's people waiting out there for you. There's people that need you. The people who have died, they've moved on, but there's people still left here on the earth that need you. And so David went back and started acting as king like he was supposed to. Now in verses 23 to 26, his new cabinet, most of them are still the old people. Verse 23, and Joab was over all the army of Israel. By the way, there was a list in 2 Samuel 8, verses 15 to 18, his first cabinet, and Joab was also over the army of Israel, as that list tells us. It says, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kehathites and the Pelethites. In other words, he was over the mercenaries. And he's the same one that's listed for us in 2 Samuel 8. Adoram, he's the new one. Adoram was in charge of revenue. In Hebrew, it literally means the labor workers. He was in charge of the labor workers and making sure that the revenues were brought into the government. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder or secretary. And he's the same one mentioned in 2 Samuel 8. Shiva, it's the same person who's the scribe. He's given a different name, Sariah, in 2 Samuel 8. Here it's Shiva. It's the same person. He was scribe. Zadok and Abiathar were the priests. That's the same as it was in 2 Samuel chapter 8. And Irah, the Jairite, was a chief minister under David. So we don't know exactly what his job was. We know nothing about him other than the fact he is listed, and he is one of the ministers there, one of his cabinet members that was in charge of a certain function in his administration there in Israel. So David he's now back on the throne. And now the last four chapters, we have two more studies in 2 Samuel, but the last four chapters of 2 Samuel are considered to be appendixes added on to the writings of Samuel to rehash, kind of give a summary statement of the victories and defeats and how God dealt with David. And we'll take two of those four, Lord willing, next week. But the lessons learned. David gained wisdom through his sin, through his error. And one of the great lessons that the recorder of 2 Samuel has been focusing on for quite a few chapters now is that David had a weakness. He himself wanted Absalom to take over after him. God didn't want Absalom. God wanted Solomon. David wanted Absalom to be the next king. And he gave him every break possible so that he could become. He didn't want to deal with him because it would ruin his opportunity to become king. Now he realizes that he should have dealt with Absalom a long time ago. That Absalom hated him. Didn't love him, hated him. He loved somebody that hated him, and he showed hatred. He made enemies David made enemies of his own people around him who were loyal to him, who loved him. That doesn't make sense. You don't give in to somebody that hates you and do wrong to the people who love you. That David was doing it all backwards. And it was all, he was just caught up in this emotional syndrome over his son Absalom. But he gained the wisdom of it. He realized that when there's rebellion and revolt against the things of the Lord, against God, what God wants you to do, and you're a leader, you've got to take care of it. You can't let it go. So he has now put his nation back together again through a lot of difficulty. This is very difficult. We read through this and say, look at the victory, look at the victory, look at the victory. But it was very difficult for David, but he already knew God was going to deliver him. He submitted to the hardship of the circumstances because God says that's your judgment. But at the same time, he knew that God was going to deliver him through it wasn't there to destroy David. It was there to keep David in that mode of a battle warrior so that he couldn't relax on his palace roof again and fall into sin again. He would be constantly involved with the battle. That's why we are. God's not going to let us rest. We're going to be constantly involved in the battle every day so that we can't take our ease. We can't walk away from the battle and start getting involved with the world and with sin again. We're involved with the battle all day, every day. It is never going to leave our household. To keep us constantly active in putting on the whole armor of God in order that we may be able to resist the attacks of Satan. Let's close with prayer. Our Heavenly Father, thank you for your book of wisdom. We thank you that we can study how you move in the lives of your people, especially David, who you said has a heart for you. Yes, he sinned, and yes, he had weaknesses, and nowhere in your word does it condemn him, nor do we. Nor do we criticize him, but only point out that he had a sin nature just like we do. That he had a heart for you just like we do. We have a heart for Christ. We want to please you. We want to do what you want us to do, but we sin and we fail. We have our weaknesses, and Satan knows the people or the activities which are our weaknesses. And we compromise. And yet through it all we gain wisdom to learn how to put on that armor and to resist the attacks of Satan. Sometimes Satan attacks through family and friends, through friendly activities and friendly people, so we can drop our guard. But help us, Lord, to maintain that obedience to Jesus Christ so that we might resist all the attacks of Satan. And help us to realize when we get discouraged that the battle goes on every day. It's not going to let up. You might give us some days off of rest, but the battle is going to start up again as a reminder to us that every day we must put on the whole armor of God and draw off of the strength of Christ and be obedient to Him in order that we might resist Satan. Remind us, Lord, that our faith is active, that we must trust You each day. It's not just a decision we make today and hope that it wears on for tomorrow automatically. We must be obedient to You in order to resist Satan. And we thank You for the words of James when he says in James 4:7, "Submit yourself to God and resist the devil, and he will flee from you." May we learn to walk in the Spirit. May we learn to respond to You, to walk with You, and understand what's going on around us and gain the wisdom from seeing You work in the lives of others who have gone before us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.